Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 3 minutes after 9:00 a.m. Monday, February 28th, 2010. With me today is Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan. Now, we'll be joined shortly by Senator Ellis and Senator Hoffman, co-chair, just depending on their other meetings they're at. Today, we have three bills on the agenda. We're going to start with Senate Bill 163, Maximum Benefit from Fisherman's Fund, House Bill 98, Alcohol Minor Consuming and Local Option, Senate Bill 83, Vocational Rehabilitation Committee. First bill up will be 163, Senate Bill by Senator Pascavan for dealing with a maximum benefit from the Fisherman's Fund. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent is to introduce the bill, take public testimony, and then set the bill aside. And with us today is Senator Pascavan, if you can come forward. Pascavan. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Pascavan, Senator from Fairbanks and Fort Wayne. Right with me today is Jake Hamburg. And Senate Bill 163 before you updates the Alaska Fisherman's Fund limit to $10,000. This will bring the program back to providing a meaningful level of assistance as the payer of last resort for commercial fishermen and crew that sustain injuries or illness while fishing. For some background, the Alaska Fisherman's Fund was established in 1951. It was set up to provide for the treatment and care of Alaska licensed commercial fishermen and crew who were injured while fishing onshore or offshore in Alaska. The upper limit on claims in the fund has remained at $2,500 since 1959. If this $2,500 in 1959 had been adjusted for the Consumer Price Index, it would be worth approximately $18,230 today. While the upper limit on claims has remained unchanged, health care costs have steadily risen. The fund is financed by revenue received from each resident and non-resident commercial fisherman's license and permit fee. In 2008, there were 13,706 commercial fishing permit holders who contributed to the fund, and that did include 135 from the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The account has grown to $11,500,000, even as health care costs have risen, due in part to continuing improvements in fishing industry safety. This bill simply updates the Fisherman's Fund limit to $10,000 to help ensuring that Alaska's fishermen have access to health care when injured while fishing. It is important to note that this increase is not projected to jeopardize the sustainability of the Alaska Fisherman's Fund. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions of the committee or yourself.
Thank you, Senator Pascavan. Can you explain to the committee the commercial fishing that goes on the Chena River?
extremely limited. I think it's limited to personal satisfaction and very little commerce. But again, it's the number of permit holders that do travel to the commercial areas in the state, and even the slips in Valdez, I believe approximately two-thirds of the slips are in Valdez are held by people from Fairbanks. And so it's, you know, we do have our attraction to the seawater of the surrounds the state.
Mm-hmm. Initial questions from committee members? Okay. Seeing none, we've got a zero fiscal note from the Department of Fish and Game. There's one positive fiscal note from the Department of Labor estimating additional 63.7 thousand in claims from the Fisherman's Fund. Should be a million, correct? Oh, excuse me, 63,000. From the Fisherman Funds, which has sufficient funds to absorb the increase. And we have no online call-ins. Okay, we'll go ahead and open it up in the room for the public hearing process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have representation from United Fishermen here.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska. We support this bill. As you know, you can't even hardly get a Band-Aid in the emergency room anymore for $2,500. So probably a good time to, after 1959, to look at this and up it a little bit so that fishermen in emergency rooms and hospitals know that they're, the upfront money's there a little bit more than $2,500. So we support the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We in another committee, we recently heard a bill that had updating outboard motors for commercial fishermen, and we're doing workman's, looks like workman's comp, health insurance sorts of things here. What sort of funds are out there that are exclusive to commercial fishermen?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins. This one here was started before statehood, and every fisherman puts $50 off their permit every year, and crew members put $23.70, I think it is, goes into the fund from CFEC off the permit fees. And then the other fund that you're talking about, Senator, is the Division of Investments that was created, if I remember right, my memory's getting a little short some days, in the 70s to encourage loans for residents to be able to keep residents in the fishery. So we created a loan program, and that was created by the legislature, and that money was paid back, and they haven't had any general funds since the very beginning of it, and it sustained itself and is aimed at getting young folks and people that fish like crews for 2 years with their captain to be able to get loans for permits and boats and for residents only. That's the only ones I know of that are out there, Senator.
Follow up?
Yeah, and just follow up. The Alaska Fishermen's Fund, what are the sources of monies that come to it? Are there sources above the $50 from fishermen?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins. No, it just goes through from the permit fees to fish and game, and then is allocated to the fisherman's fund. It's $50 on every, it was on every permit you had. Now it's $50 for the first permit that if you're a multi-permit holder, you only pay once, $50. And then the crews, part of the crew money goes is $23. That's where the source is. That's the only source of funding that they have.
Okay.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, you mentioned crews. So the crew members also have a toll. It's crew members, and then there's just the permit holder. Did I hear you correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, yes.
Okay.
The permit holders and the crew. $50 for the permit holder, every permit. If I buy my permit, $50 of that fee, which is around $300 and some I pay to go fishing, $50 of that goes over to the fisherman's fund. And then when the crew pays theirs, $90 or resident one, which is, can't remember the price of that one. I haven't had been a crew in a long time. $23 of that goes over to the fisherman's fund.
So what you're talking about is when an individual comes in and buys a crew member license.
Yes.
A portion of that license fee when he purchases his crew member license goes to the fisherman's fund. And this has been in place since the 50s.
Yeah, since just before statehood, yes, Mr. Chairman. The portion that they pay, $23 is a portion of what they pay goes to that. And then $50 from whatever your fee is, if it's $300 or $1,000, $50 goes to the fund for a permit holder.
Do you happen to know the breakout of, maybe we can get somebody from Fish and Game to help us or whatever, the breakout between out-of-state commercial fishermen licenses sold and in-state, what that ratio is?
Mr. Chairman, you mean on the just the breakout of the people that pay into the fund?
Correct.
I wouldn't know that. The department's here, maybe.
All right, might, we'll bring them up here shortly. Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McCune, as we look at this, the health issue, it's becoming more and more important to have coverage because expenses are going up, but I'm not familiar with how it works. How does the, if somebody gets hurt, I can understand if they're a subscriber to the fund, they would get funding to go ahead and cover their costs. But let's say that it's a, if they have alternate insurance, alternate health insurance, is the fisherman's fund the first payer for that? And I guess I'm really was wondering about those fishermen, either permit holders or otherwise, that are covered under the Native Health Service. Do they bill the Native Health Service or do they go to the fisherman's fund first?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the way I understand it, it's not your primary insurance. But if you have insurance and there's some things that the insurance is not covering, then you can apply to the fisherman's fund. If you have, you don't have any insurance, then you can apply to the fisherman's fund, and then there's a council made up of fishermen that review all claims and denials. You have to be injured while you're fishing or at the dock or some associated with moving something, seine or a gillner. You have to be some activity that you're fishing, and you have to have that documented, then you apply to the fisherman's fund if you don't have insurance. But such as if you do have primary insurance, most they prefer that you first apply for that, and then you can apply for the fisherman's fund.
Mr. Chairman, if, just a comment. I guess I kind of find it concerning that you have to go ahead and pay this fee to cover this fund, and then when you get hurt, if you're it sounds like you're penalized if you're putting health insurance, other covered by other health insurance plans that you're actually paying for on top of what you have, right? That's what I'm hearing you say, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson. Yeah, that's what it says in there. It doesn't always, the department's probably best to answer a lot of these questions. The way I understand you, it's not your primary insurance, but if you do have other insurance, you know, they encourage you to apply that, and then you can also apply to the Fisherman's Fund also. Most of the claims, I think, last year were around $1,000. Emergency room things and things like that.
One last comment, Mr. Chairman. It certainly sounds like those, especially those, I'm concerned about those people up in my district that are fishermen, that are native, if they're, and they're covered by the Native Health system, that they're paying into this fund and never get its benefits.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I'm not sure exactly if it's true that if you have other insurance if we use this as your primary insurance, everybody did, all fishermen, they're probably $11 million wouldn't last too long. Mm-hmm. If every claim that didn't go through other insurance, it'd probably really put a tax in this fund pretty quickly. I think it's about $1 million that goes in there every year. So if people were going to use it as their primary, and there's some people that don't have insurance, then that's certainly they can apply over the amount of $10,000. If you don't have insurance, it has to be approved by the council. I understand the concern, but the $11 million would be ate up in a big hurry if everybody was going to use it as their primary insurance.
And remind me what the deductible is?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, on the Fisherman's Fund?
Yes.
Right now it's up to $2,500.
Okay.
But you can apply over the $2,500 to the council. Beyond that, for circumstances and certain things that carry on. So what we're trying to do is raise it to $10,000 so that the certainty in the emergency rooms and hospitals know they're working with a certain amount bigger than $2,500, so you don't have to go to the council and apply for more for certain injuries.
And this insurance is available to all fishermen, even those that are shellfish type fishermen?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, anybody that buys a state permit or a crew license.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have Mike Monagle here from Department of Labor.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Mike Monagle. I'm a program coordinator for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and have with me Paula Scavera, who's a special assistant to the commissioner's office.
You help the committee sort out some of this stuff as far as?
Be happy to answer your questions.
If you know, the one of the questions was the ratio of out-of-state to in-state, and any other clarifications you want to throw on the table?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have it broken down into a percentage, but I do have a spreadsheet that maybe we can make a copy and make it available to the committee that shows resident and non-resident permits and crew member licenses. And these statistics come to us from Fish and Game and Limited Entry Commission. Okay. The funds are transferred to our fund from Fish and Game monthly, and they come to us from Limited Entry Commission twice a year, semi-annually.
And how is this fund working in the department's opinion? Do you support this bill?
For the record, my name is Paula Scavero. I'm a special assistant to the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development. Not only does the department support the bill, the administration supports the bill as is.
Is there anything else you want to add to respond to Senator Olson's questions as far as first payee and second payee and who qualifies and who doesn't?
Mr. Chairman, the way the fund operates is we are, based on Attorney General opinion, a payer of last resort. So we do ask if they have primary insurance, if they have a private health plan, if they have other types of insurance, including IHS, Indian Health Services. We are a second payer, so they would present to those primary insurers first, then come to the fund, and the fund would consider any unpaid balance that the claimant would have.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Realizing that the Native Health Service, through their health corporations that are out there as nonprofit organizations, it sounds like then if a Native person whose health issues gets taken care of by the health corporation as the primary PE, that the Fisherman's Fund would not pay anything out at all. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that's correct. If they presented to an IHS provider and those funds were taken care of, the claim was taken care of, then we would not pay. In application, a lot of times fishermen are treated at clinics. A lot of times the clinics are remote, and a lot of times the services are by contract service providers. When they have a contract service provider, we do consider the fund as the primary payer. It's only when they get services from an IHS facility, not through a contractor.
Well, I find it kind of concerning that if a Native fisherman gets hurt, that for all this money that he's put in, whether he's a permit holder or a deckhand, that he's forced to go ahead and pay, but he can't access that fund at all.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that's correct. If they had a deductible, I'm not sure how IHS pays their claims, but if they don't pay in full, they can certainly take the balance. If you consider the maximum on a crew member license to be, you know, approximately $25 or $60 for a permit, prescription drugs, any of those other types of fees that they might have that aren't paid by IHS, they could come to us for that assistance.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that they don't. And as far as remoteness goes, the health corporations are in my district are the ones that run all the clinics. In fact, have the main facility, and that's usually what it is out in northern, western, and southwestern Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Huggins.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, my limited experience here in the Capitol was when the term workman's compensation was on the table, every special interest group that I ever heard of showed up in the building. I mean, talk about special interest, but I see in this case, the Workman's Compensation Division is working this, which brings the question of workman's compensation. And I see the average claim cost. What are some of the upper end claims that were made, just so we have a sampling of what transpired over the last couple of 3 years?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, there is a $2,500 limit currently on the administrator's ability to pay funds. The way the statute reads, it says, except for compelling reasons. So the fisherman can make an argument to the Fisherman's Fund Advisory Council and ask for an extension of benefits for, quote, compelling reasons. The council has pretty broad statutory authority to consider additional benefit to fishermen. We get each year approximately $400,000 in these requests for extended benefits. Last year, one of the claims that we paid was in excess of $200,000. So the council is not limited to the $2,500. It's just the administration that's limited to the $2,500. Increasing the benefit to $10,000 would simply allow the administration of the fund to the $10,000 maximum without us having to refer the injured fisherman to the council for additional benefits. So we can make decisions quicker and get bills paid faster without going to our council. As you know, our council is made up of commercial fishermen, so we only meet twice a year. It's difficult to meet more frequently than that because they are commercial fishermen. And then finally, your question on workers' compensation. Our program is housed in the Division of Workers' Compensation, but the commercial fishermen and the Workers' Comp Act are specifically excluded from coverage under workers' compensation.
Follow up?
Yeah, and in the case, Seaman Huggins falls overboard, never to be seen again. What happens? What in regards to this fund and other sources? And let me just caveat that by I'm assuming that the captain, the owner, somebody has to have insurance that covers what goes on the boat, the ship, whatever you want to call it.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the fund does not provide death benefits. So in the event that a fisherman is killed in the scope and course of commercial fishing, unfortunately, the fund would not pay any benefits. Fishermen do have recourse through Jones Act remedy, but as you know, that's a civil action. And when someone's trying to go to a clinic and be treated and have their benefits paid for, they're not in a position to have to wait a couple of years for litigation, if that's the case, to get a claim. My experience is that most vessel owners do carry protection and indemnity insurance for that type of situation. And in fact, there have been circumstances where the council has paid a portion on a claim and instructed the claimant, particularly on large claims, that they might wish to pursue a claim in against the P&I carrier to be made whole. One of the things that P&I does that the fund doesn't do is they can pay for lost wages and indemnity benefits while the injured fisherman is unable to work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can you help us with this chart? There's a chart in the packet talking about showing the historical revenue and claims, and it looks like you're running a deficit for the last 4 years, and what your expectations are if we have this change in the future, and how long your $11.5 million will last.
Mr. Chairman, the deficits in recent years were due in part to some of the extension amounts. The council, because of the fund balance, has been generous with some of the requests. As I mentioned last year, we had a single claim that was in excess of $200,000. So some of the amounts of the benefits in recent years, if you look down the chart, for fiscal year 09 was almost $1 million in benefits paid. And if you look down in prior years, it varied, but certainly was much less than $1 million. So the council has been more generous when it has funding. As I mentioned, the extension requests, those injuries that are in excess of $10,000 aren't that many. And the council does have discretionary authority in paying those large claims. And one of the factors that the council can consider is availability of funding. And so when the fund does have resources, the council is in a position to pay those large claims. However, should the fund balance drop, and we would anticipate it will, we believe that $11 million is probably a higher amount in the fund than needs to be there. So if it does come down in the fund balance, I would anticipate that the council would become more strict in awarding those extensions of benefits above that $10,000 amount.
And then this chart that you handed out can maybe help the committee with that a little bit. Year 09, and again, when we, you know, it is just put in front of me, so I'm not quite sure. It takes a little bit sometimes to get used to the layout. But in 2009, there was non-residents 9,500, residents 9,500 and non-residents 8.6 in numbers of licensees. But down at the bottom, the non-resident is almost double the revenue than the resident. So can you help me just decipher that real quick?
Mr. Chairman, the contribution in the statute is 39% of a crew member license or permit up to a cap of $60. And the amount that comes in on a resident crew member license or resident permit is on the low end, so that's why the numbers come in on the revenue lower, because the non-residents pay at a higher contribution rate.
Okay. And then the claims experience from residents and non-residents. You have a brief synopsis of the claims experience?
Mr. Chairman, I do not have it broken down by resident.
Maybe you could get back to the committee, because we're not going to take action on this bill. Get back to the committee with a comparison of residents, non, and non-residents, not only contributions but claims. We have any other questions for the Senator Huggins and then Senator Thomas?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One category that was, I guess, a surprise to me is child. What's the child provision?
Mr. Chairman, through Senator Huggins, there is a child crew member license. Each person that is engaged in commercial fishing on the vessel has to be licensed. There is, I think, 14 years old is the age limit on that. They have to actually possess a child crew member's license.
Thank you.
I think some families have experienced that issue when their child is virtually out of diapers and able to stand on the deck.
On that
literally,
issue, Mr. Chairman.
On
that issue.
Okay, and then we'll go to Senator Thomas.
So
Senator Olson.
14 and above, you need a child permit license, or 14 and below?
I believe it's 14 and below.
14 and below, you need a child license in order to, because the families are on board. And if they don't have a license, they get violated?
Through the chair, I'm not sure if they would be violated, because, you know, we don't get involved in the enforcement of fishing regulations.
Thank you, Mr.
But
Chairman.
But if they didn't have the crew member license,
Senator Thomas,
come to us, we wouldn't pay the benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things. Is this a calendar year or a fiscal year we're looking at? I'm looking at 09's claims, and if it says it's only through through February of 09, so is it calendar or fiscal year, this?
Through the chair, this is a fiscal year.
Fiscal year.
The license of permits is a yes.
Okay. And the money is invested where? By who?
The money is a dedicated fund. It's tracked as part of the general fund program, but it's kind of, it's not in the general funds. The Fisherman's Fund itself does not earn interest on the investments of the fund. It's tracked. There is a provision in statute that says up to 50% of the earnings of the fund may be used for safety programs for commercial fishermen.
I think it's in the Jafonsi classification when we get into the general fund.
And then, just the last thing. I was looking at some of the trends, though, on your chart. Numbers of claims down dramatically from the first few years, which is good. You know, we're being safer. The average cost of claims up about three times. Receipts down somewhat dramatically from the early years. And benefits paid are, you know, somewhat static, depending on how you want to look at that. So I guess when we look at the column, the surplus or deficit, I guess it would be somewhat concerning, although you are correct. There's a lot of money there based on the small percentage that it has gone down from 06 to 09, but certainly something to pay attention to. That's all. Thank you.
Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, I guess I'm still confused about how this legislation about increasing it to $10,000 will affect the surplus deficit column. You had a deficit last fiscal year of $124,000. With the implementation of Senate Bill 163, have you projected at all how this will affect this fund?
Through the chair, Senator Egan, we have. Again, the administration's ability to approve a claim is limited to $2,500. That doesn't mean a claimant can't ask for more. In fact, that frequently happens. When we have our semi-annual council meetings, we typically bring in the neighborhood of 100 claims to those council meetings for the council to review. So in fact, some of those claims in excess of $2,500 have been paid. They just have to go through this somewhat lengthy process of filing an appeal and waiting 6 months to go to a council review. We did take a look at the number of claims whose bills fell between $2,500 and $10,000 and felt that paying those would have a financial impact of an increase of about $65,000 to the fund. Given the fund balance, we felt that we could sustain that type of increase, and we believe it will bring the fund balance down gradually, but that's something that we'll have to just watch in the coming years and adjust benefit payments accordingly.
You can give sure follow-up, but before you do, the committee would like you to bring back some follow-up information, you know, when you do your claims, to break out the number of claims below 2,500 and the number of claims in the ranges above 2,500, so we can get a feel over the last, like, pick 5 years or some reasonable number back a few. You don't have to go back to territorial days, but, you know, just kind of give us a feel for what's going on. Yeah, Senator Egan, you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, and one more thing. Who administers or decides what the fund balance at year-end is going to be?
Through the chair, Senator Egan, well, I guess it's a moving amount, a moving target, if you will. We don't set a fund balance. When we typically go to council and the council's considering some of these large claims, they are taking a look at the fund balance and deciding, well, do we have, in the instance of a $200,000 claim, do we have the resources to pay that kind of claim? And if we pay that kind of claim, what impact will it have? Those are things that the council members talk about when they're deliberating paying those extra benefits. But we don't have a set target at the beginning or the end of the year where we want to be by year end.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions from the department? So, Mr. Monagle, are you a refugee from Peterson Avenue?
I am.
Grew up right next to me in Sitka, literally. And thank you. And if you can get back to that information to the committee, and then my office will go ahead and distribute it amongst the members. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Do we have anybody else in the audience that want to speak to this bill before we set it aside? Okay, we'll go on to the next item on the agenda. Which is House Bill 98 by Representative Ramirez concerning minors consuming alcohol and local option. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent is to introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside. With us today is Mr. Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Jane Pearson is here with me. Mr. Chairman.
If you could just identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Jay Ramirez from District 10 in Fairbanks. Nice to see you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there are three types of minor consuming. There's minor consuming, which is the first offense, repeat minor consuming, which is the second offense, and habitual minor consuming with the third offense. This bill is a fix-it bill. It grew out of House Bill 359, which we passed in the 25th legislature. Senator Huggins, HB 359 in the 25th legislature was an effort to get the state to take its thumb off of young men and women that had been convicted of minor consuming and allow them to join the military. Previously, if they were on probation with the state through the age of 21, then they did not have access to America's greatest vocational rehab training opportunity, which is the United States military. As we got into this, Mr. Chairman, we found that we needed to introduce House Bill 98 because we had created the equivalent of a Bill Murray Groundhog Day situation where an individual would be convicted of the first offense of minor consuming. They would get a suspended sentence, and then because of the way the cumbersome nature of the statute, they would never be able to be convicted of repeat minor consuming. And so I can have Jane take you through the specifics of it, but all we're trying to do is disentangle the language to make it possible for a young person who is demonstrating truant behavior to move through minor consuming, and if they're well behaved, then they get a suspended sentence. If they're not well behaved, then they should proceed to a second offense and then to a third offense so that the court system recognizes their poor behavior. And I'll let Jane Pearson answer any additional questions for you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Go ahead.
For the record, my name's Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Ramirez. And basically, as Representative said, this is a fixed bill because what was happening was if a person was convicted of minor consuming under the B2 provision of the statute, they would not be placed on probation. And the way the statute read, they had to be placed on probation before they could get to a repeat minor consuming. We had a slight change on the House floor to this bill, which was to include that minor consuming and repeat minor consuming are not criminal offenses. They are not a misdemeanor. Only habitual minor consuming is a misdemeanor. And on the other side, we are also asked by the Department of Law to put in a fix in this bill to the bootlegging provisions to bring the sentencing and the penalties in line with the DUI felony provisions.
Do we have any questions from committee members? I see Representative Ramirez is busy writing his vote countdown.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
It looks pretty good.
Okay. Seeing no questions from the committee members, we have no one on the call-in sheet. There's no one on the sign-up sheet. Is there anybody here that's too shy to sign up on the sign-up sheet but wants to come forward and speak on this bill? Okay, with that, we have 3-0 fiscal notes and one indeterminate note from the Department of Corrections. We have made a request and are still waiting for an update on the FY11 fiscal note from the Department of Corrections. So we'll wait till we get complete documentation and come back review that issue. Any final questions, comments, concerns? Okay, thank you. We'll go ahead and set this aside. Bring up the next piece of work for the committee today, Senate Bill 83 by the governor regarding vocational rehabilitation committee. This is our final piece of labor today. This is the first hearing on a bill. The intent is to introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside. We have with us today Cheryl Welsh, Director of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, to come forward, give us the presentation. And if you could introduce yourself for the record and speak to the bill, please.
Good morning. My name is Cheryl Walsh. I'm the Director of the Alaska Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, which is located within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Senate Bill 83 is an act which repeals the Governor's Committee on Employment and Rehabilitation of People with Disabilities and creates the State Vocational Rehabilitation Committee. The purpose of the legislation is to bring current state statute into compliance with federal laws. During the week of May 5th of this year, a monitoring team from our Federal Rehabilitation Services Administration will be in Alaska, so the division is very interested in having this bill pass prior to their visit. The bill repeals the Governor's Committee on Employment and People with Disabilities and creates the State Vocational Rehabilitation Committee. The State Vocational Rehabilitation Committee will function as both the State Rehabilitation Council and the Assistive Technology Advisory Committee, both of which are required by federal law to accept funding for the Assistive Technology Grant and to operate the Vocational Rehabilitation Client Services Program, which assists Alaskans with disabilities to obtain employment. The membership requirements of both of these committees are very similar. The bill addresses the appointment, number, and composition of the committee members. Membership described in current state statute is related to a board that is no longer required nor is no longer relevant. The bill is designed to allow the composition of the committee to change without revising state statutes if federal regulations change. This was done at the recommendation of legislators during the 2007 legislative session. Since the committee is funded with the same funds that are used to provide services and to make assistive technology available to Alaskans with disabilities, the division is not interested in growing the size of the committee beyond what is required. There are no paid staff to this committee. The bill also addresses the selection and term of the committee chair. It eliminates the need for the governor to appoint the chair. It allows the members to vote to make this election subject to disapproval from the governor. The bill provides for 4 meetings per year, which may be conducted telephonically. The committee currently makes sure that at least one of the meetings is held in a rural location. The ability to conduct meetings telephonically allows for the committee members to participate when their disability may make travel difficult, and if necessary and appropriate, telephonic meetings could also be used as a means to control some expenses. The bill also allows for a smooth transition of the committee members to the State Vocational Rehabilitation Committee. In closing, I'd like to speak to the value that this committee brings to the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. This committee brings an important external view to the agency. Members act as a voice for consumers and other stakeholders in the public rehabilitation system. Without the structure of a volunteer, governor-appointed board, the committee would not have access to the talent, wisdom, and expertise that the members bring. The majority of the members also bring the perspective of what it is like to live with a disability. Their perspectives enrich the program greatly as we conduct the statewide needs assessment, survey consumer satisfaction, host community forums, review agency policies, and make recommendations to improve service provision. At each of their quarterly meetings, they reserve an entire hour where they take public testimony. And this hour is always filled with really valuable information. Committee members recently met with legislators and they handed out their annual report, and it looks like this. If anybody would like a copy, I'd certainly be glad to give it to you. And on a final note, I'd like to say that creating the State Vocational Rehabilitation Committee would end confusion that currently results between the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education and the Governor's Committee on Employment and Rehabilitation of People with Disabilities. Although the purpose of each board is very different, the public often confuses the two because of the name. So thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Ms. Walsh, I notice that this is coming down from our beloved federal government, and I'm just wondering if you can kind of give us a little more of a highlight on the impact of the costs and is this an unfunded mandate coming from them, or what is the administration's opinion on that? And then also, if you could add, there was a comment that in the future it wouldn't have to come back for legislative adjustments; it could be just done administratively, and what impact that may have on the appropriation authority or impact dealing with our operating budgets.
Chairman, this committee is funded with the client services budget that we currently have. The committee is funded about $65,000 per year, The legislation would require about 15 members. That member fluctuates slightly because of the requirement for members to 51% of the board to have disabilities. This really is correcting the composition because of administrative order that combined three committees at one time, and the committee membership was tied to the president's committee on employment of people with disabilities, which is a committee that's no longer required. And so the membership was never really in alignment with what we require. The current legislation provides for about 12 members. It caps it at 12. We don't see it really going above the 15 mark. You'll see a fiscal note there. The difference in three members would be about $6,500 per year, which we would fund from our current grant that we receive.
So the it'll be fully, the three additional seats will be fully funded by the federal government, and they're the ones asking for it. Is that a simple way of looking at the adjustment?
Yes.
An accurate, simple way.
We do have a match requirement for our grant. However, the majority of the funding comes from the federal government, and they have not changed their membership requirements since 1998. So I don't see that this would be changing significantly. We're trying to correct a statute that's been in place that hasn't really been in alignment.
And then in the future, if the federal government decides that the 7.5 is a number they want to change on our fiscal note to cut that number in half, as an example, because of whatever budget constraints they may be faced with, what kind of response is the administration prepared to give to that scenario or type of scenarios? Reduced federal funding.
We have a variety of ways that we could conduct the meetings, and that's where the telephonic method is also included. In the previous legislation, the ability to have a telephonic meeting was not included, and so I think there's ways to save costs regardless. We prefer an in-person meeting just because we're the population that we serve and the ability to have more participation, but if we needed to, we could resort to telephonic meetings or shorten the length of the meetings. I think there's a variety of ways to cut costs if we needed to.
Okay. We have questions from committee members. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there within the old committee, the Governor's Committee on Employment of People with Disabilities, and transferred on then, of course, to the State Vocational Rehabilitation Committee, a measuring mechanism for basically the purpose, which is stated right after the first change, some way to measure the impact that, that is actually taking place as far as on individuals, number of individuals that are placed in employment, or at least up their abilities are upgraded to allow them more opportunity. Is that a statistic that we keep at this point in time?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, are you asking for how many people we employ on an annual basis?
How many people are moved or upgraded in their ability to earn a living based on this particular commission or committee? Or do you just address overall issues and don't keep track of the, I guess I'm looking for a success rate, you know, what happens through the committee, the new committee, or the old committee, as far as what are the results? What is taking place? Do you keep statistics showing that on an annual basis, this many number of folks were treated through, or served through the various committees that you oversee, I guess, and that there's some positive impact on numbers of folks?
Through the chair,
Senator. I don't know how to make it any clearer. I'm sorry.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Thomas, the services provided are provided through vocational rehabilitation counselors, but the role of the committee is when we change a policy, such as our self-employment policy, the committee reviews it, and we have four employers on the committee that help to give us input about the impact. We have one that's he's self-employed in rural Alaska, and he gives us valuable input about business development. They're advisory in that regard. They also assist monthly. Anybody who is closed from our program who has received services, they survey to get an indication of client satisfaction. For it's a continuous improvement kind of a committee. So they don't actually aren't tied to the placements of individuals, but for your information, 549 individuals with significant disabilities were placed in competitive employment last year through the division.
Well, I guess that's getting at it. If in fact that number is increased by the activity of this committee, I guess is what I'm looking at.
I would say that it increases our quality. I wouldn't say necessarily that potentially numbers, but there would be really no way to connect that directly to a committee member.
Okay, that's fine.
Right. Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sarah, as I look at the bill before us today, it has a category of people which are eligible to be on the committee. Could you just tell us, under the present standing committee, which categories are represented? And you'll find that on page 2 in the bill, on line 5.
Through the chair, would you please ask the second part of your question again, which?
Right. There presently is a standing committee, right, that is called Governor's Committee on Employment of People with Disabilities?
Correct.
Right. So line 5 of the bill lays out who the qualifications, the background, the people that will be on the committee. And I'm asking you, the standing committee now, which one of these groups of people are represented? Are there fraternal, or they're civic, or the agriculture?
Through the chair, these are the current ones that are listed here. The ones that are required are one vocational rehabilitation counselor, one certified rehabilitation provider, four business, industry, or labor representatives, an individual that's on the Alaska Workforce Investment Board, the statewide independent living council, either the chairperson or a designee, one parent training representative, one tribal vocational rehabilitation representative, the client assistance program representative, myself, the Vocation Rehabilitation Director, a statewide education representative, and former or current vocation rehabilitation consumers, and then a representative of individuals who have difficulty representing themselves because of their disability. That's what would be, that is what's currently required in federal legislation. These other ones that are in brackets are the ones that were previously required.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So the administration supports this bill?
That's correct.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, we have one other representative, a special assistant from the Department of Labor, the only person sitting in the audience. We'll have the entire audience come up, please, to testify on the bill. If you could state your name again for the record, please, and help us with the...
For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I'm Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development. I'm not really here for testimony, just questions and moral support for Cheryl.
Okay. And you just had marked a box, wish to testify, so...
Oh, I'm sorry. It's here for questions only.
Okay. Do we have any questions for her? Seeing none, we have nobody. We have one other person from the governor's office here. Called in. Not sure. Jutsi? Carla Jutsi? You might want to help me with the pronunciation of your name and then put yourself on the record and speak to the bill, please.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I am Carla Jutsi. I'm the Executive Director at the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, and I'm a newly appointed member of the Governor's Committee in a seat for community rehabilitation providers. I would encourage your approval of this legislation. It will correct a situation where an outdated Alaska statute makes it difficult for the governor's office to make appointments to the committee that are also in compliance with current federal regulation. Thank you.
Do we have any questions for her? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
There's one fiscal note from the Department of Labor reflecting the 7,500 increase in travel per diem and per diem for the three additional members of the committee. The cost will be absorbed in the division's current budget. We have any final questions, comments on this bill before we set it aside? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside. Unless there's additional comments, concerns, from the committee, our next meeting is tomorrow, February 9th, 9:30 a.m. Please note that the time change, it's 9:30, so we'll start a half hour late. There's four appropriation bills on the agenda. Senate Bill 253, Deferred Maintenance Appropriation, Senate Bill 254, FY10, Supplemental Appropriations, Senate Bill 229, Operating Budget, Senate Bill 231, Mental Health Budget. We may not get all that done in an hour and a half, so stand by on the flexibility of our schedule as we go forward. Thanks, everybody, for coming today. Meeting adjourned.